Don't think of an elephant. Especially don't think of a Tai Chi practicing adventure-seeking blue elephant answering with a smile to the name of Pickles. Once that image is implanted in your mind, it's even harder not to think about the elephant, though despite the fact that Pickles might not have been the first elephant that came to mind. In part, that may be because Pickles managed to transcend her own identity as just an elephant and seemed much more as an equal, a companion on life's journey. Clearly, she did this for Pete, though let us not forget Pete's own transformation in the story. Pete becomes more than your own run-of-the-mill, stuck-in-the-mud pig. They both remind us of the human condition, dealing with life as best we can. Of course, most of us know the linguistics at play when we tell someone not to think of something. Invariably, we think about it, whether we want to or not. So chances are, each of you thought of an elephant. Some of you may have thought of an elephant you saw on a TV or at a zoo. Some of you may have thought of Dumbo. Some of you may have thought of Pickles. A few of you, like me, may remember the elephant from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, the one where the rogue parade elephant mistook Chuckles the Clown for a peanut, since Chuckles was in a peanut costume, and tried to de-shell him. The episode is hailed as the funniest TV episode of all time, and the elephant clearly didn't see a human being upon first, second, or even probably third gaze. But then each of us is more than the shell we present, the costume we wear. There is more to each of us than others see or know. How often do we look for that? A few years ago in the Northwest, it was arranged at my tennis club for me to play with one of the better older tennis players at my club. At 68, Bob was in excellent shape, and he regaled me with tales of winning many tennis championships in the state of Washington in his younger days. We played a fun match, which I won, to Bob's surprise. As we were chatting and packing up, he asked me, "How long have you been fat?" I was somewhat taken aback by the question, but I answered it had pretty much been most of my adult life. He then told me if I lost a little weight, I'd be a real tennis player. I then got a bit of a lecture on diet and that I needed to work out more. He then said he was surprised at how smart I was on the tennis court and how quickly I chased down tennis balls. It was only then that he sort of half realized that what he was saying might not be perceived as good and possibly insulting. And he said, "I probably didn't need a lecture on all of this." Fortunately, ministry is good preparation for being thick-skinned, and to see an insult as an opportunity for sermon fodder. So I just smiled, and I said I looked forward to playing again, thinking to myself I would have good motivation for the next time we played. But it also made me think that Bob had a clear picture of what a tennis player looked like, especially one that could beat him. And I wasn't it. He didn't expect me to be faster than him or smart for whatever reasons. Clearly, he'd made some assumptions. I suspect if I had told Bob, "Don't think of a tennis player," I would not have been the first tennis player that came to his mind. But then we all have these preconceptions, these stereotypes, even when we know better. Don't think of a nurse. Don't think of a gang member. Don't think of a genius. Don't think of the person sitting next to you on the airplane who's wearing pink slippers. Don't think of Santa Claus. If we were honest, each of us had very distinct and probably stereotypical images that came to mind when we weren't thinking about these things. It's also possible we were able to expand that once we thought about it more, but we often had one image that came first. And I know that's true for me. I still think of a middle-aged female as a nurse before I remember that my friends Frank and Edwin are both nurses too. I still think of a gang member as being a person of color, and then I remind myself of the stories of gangs of white girls that exist too. Albert Einstein comes to mind before Marie Curie, George Washington Carver, or Stephen Hawking when I think of a genius. The person sitting next to me in pink slippers on the airplane this summer was a guy, a white guy in his 20s. He also had no problem exposing his plaid boxers, his tattoos on his arm that weren't covered by his sleeveless t-shirt. And I bet that wasn't the first image that came to your mind when I said, think of a person in pink slippers. It certainly wouldn't have been mine, though I must say it has left quite an impression. Recently, I read this account of racial stereotyping in our society from a small town in rural Ohio. Two first grade teachers had agreed to let a professor observe their class for a year. There were 33 students. Two-thirds were white, and the other third were African-American or of mixed race descent. In December, the teachers read to the classes, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," Melody Rozelle's retelling of the Clement Seymour classic. As the teachers began to read, the kids were excited about the book's depiction of a family waiting for Santa to come. A few children, however, quietly fidgeted. They seemed puzzled that this storybook was different. In this one, it was a black family all snug in their beds. And as the story unfolded and the tension mounted, the teacher turned the page. And the children saw something they really hadn't expected. They saw Santa was black. "He's black," gasped a little white girl. A white boy exclaimed, "I thought he was white." Immediately, the children began to chatter about this stunning development. At the ripe old age of 6 or 7, the children had no doubt that there was a real Santa. Of that, they were absolutely sure. But suddenly, there was this huge question mark. Could Santa be black? And if so, what did that mean? Well, some of the black children were delighted with the idea that Santa could be black. Others were unsure. A couple of white children rejected this out of hand. A black Santa couldn't be real. But even the little girl, most adamant that the real Santa must be white, came around to accept the possibility that a black Santa could fill in for a white Santa if white Santa was hurt. And she still gleefully yelled with a black Santa's final, "Merry Christmas to all, y'all sleep tight," at the end of the story. Other children offered the idea that perhaps Santa was mixed with black and white, something in the middle, like an Indian. One boy went with the two Santa theories. White Santa and black Santa must be friends who take turns visiting the children. When a teacher apparently made the huge mistake of saying she'd never seen Santa, the children all quickly corrected her. Everyone had seen Santa at the mall. Not that that clarified the situation any. The debate raged in the classroom for over a week in anticipation of the school party. The kids knew the real Santa was going to be the guest of honor. Then Santa arrived at the party, and he was black, just like in the picture. Some white children said this black Santa was too thin, that the real one was the fat Santa down at the Kmart. But one of the white girls retorted that she'd met the man and was convinced Santa was brown. Most of the black children in the class were exultant, since this proved that Santa was black. But one of them, Brent, still doubted, even though he really wanted a black Santa to be true. So he bravely confronted Santa. "There aren't any black Santas," he said. "Look here," Santa said, and he pulled up a pants leg. And a thrilled Brent was sold. "This is a black Santa," he yelled. "He's got black skin." But the black Santa storybook wasn't enough to crush every stereotype. When the children were later asked to draw Santa, even the black kids who were excited about a black Santa, many of them still depicted him with skin as snowy white as his beard. But the shock of the Santa storybook was a catalyst for these first graders to have a year-long conversation about race issues. The teachers began to regularly incorporate books that deals with issues of racism into their reading. And when the children were reading a book about Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement, both black and the white children noticed that the white people were nowhere to be found in the story. And troubled, they decided to find out where in history both peoples were. Now, that story I just told you has made me think of several things. And the first thing it made me think of were two Dennis the Menace cartoons. In one, Dennis tells his pal Joey, when they see a store Santa, he's got twin brothers all over the place. But the other is one of Dennis sitting in Santa's lap. Santa is looking completely dazed and befuddled by Dennis's question, because Dennis has asked the multi-layered question of Santa, do you believe in yourself? Several other things jump out at me, though. One is how easily the kids talk to each other about race. Trying to do that with adults is much harder. In fact, the report also cites that parents don't want to talk to their kids about race, that most parents hope that by just putting their children in a multicultural setting, showing them a multicultural TV show, that that will be enough. But the research says differently. The research says kids are more likely to not have friends of different races and just notice their parents' racial prejudices. What does work is when parents talk about race with their kids. But what does seem to be true is parents are afraid of saying the wrong thing and making things worse. And what it does when this happens, it teaches the kids that it's not okay to talk about race, at least with their parents and often with others. Or rather, that's what the white parents do. People of color are more likely to talk to their children about race and racism, including the fact that they will likely face discrimination. Though it seems to work best when it's talked about but not dwelled upon too much. There have been a couple of times that I've seen this change. One was after Hurricane Katrina, and now more recently around the Black Lives Matter movement. We will see if these are conversations that last. However, look at what a conversation about a black Santa Claus can do to a classroom of first graders in rural Ohio. What would happen if we could have conversations like that all the time? I think one of the reasons why we don't is because too many people are afraid that they will reveal biases they have or discover biases they didn't know they had. Yet we all have them, and people have biases toward us. As a person who was born in Appalachian East Tennessee, when I share that piece of my identity first, I notice people assume that I am poor, uneducated, conservative theologically, and in some ways have to be related to Dolly Parton. They are surprised that my family has no Dolly connections, but we did grow up on the same mountain that Alex Haley lived on, the author of Roots. People are even more surprised that my East Tennessee Southern Baptist family on my mother's side is more liberal and less freaked out about having their gay cousin nephew be a UU minister than my father's Connecticut Congregationalist family who idolized Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, and Sarah Palin. As a person introduced as a UU minister, people then are surprised to learn that I come from East Tennessee, and I've had people say that they discovered I was smarter than they expected me to be. But often when we only know a piece of a person's identity, biases do come to mind. Another good example is around culture and geography. And I like to do this when I talk about different places in the United States. And one of the places I like to talk about is Alaska. Because when you talk about Alaska, people forget that there are things like grocery stores and Starbucks and universities in Alaska. It used to be that people only thought about nature, but now what they associate with Alaska is Sarah Palin, even though she doesn't live there anymore. Had many interesting conversations with people to work to dispel with them about their biases about Alaska and to talk about the Alaska culture as a way to help people understand some of what is going on in terms of how someone like Sarah Palin could be elected. But I also like to talk about some of the very positive things about Alaska and compare and contrast it with other places in the United States, like Massachusetts. I love talking with people from Massachusetts who clearly have a bias or two about Alaska, and I tell them this story. When I lived in Medford, Massachusetts, I had three sets of neighbors. One set of neighbors I bonded with in my first winter when we were both stuck in a blizzard and we had to shovel each other out to get out. There is something about a blizzard that makes people in New England friendly to one another. I had another set of neighbors across the street who didn't speak for me for 6 years. When they did finally say hello, they said, "It looks like you're going to stick around for a while." I had another set of neighbors who never spoke to me at all, even when I waved. On the other hand, people in Alaska talk to you. They ask you where you're from, how long you've been in Alaska. There's no breaking in period, no wait to see if you're going to stay around. You're welcome there in a way I never saw in Massachusetts. And I also like to tell the folks in Massachusetts about the poorly marked streets of Boston. Okay, not the poorly marked, the unnamed streets of Boston. When I first moved to Boston in 1996, I was telling a group of coworkers about how arrogant I found Boston to be. Perplexed, they asked me how could I possibly think of them as arrogant. "Well, it's the street signs," I said. "Most of the streets aren't marked. If you don't know where you're going..." And then, in unison, all 10 of my coworkers interrupted me and finished my sentence for me. "Well, then you don't belong here," they all said. And they all looked very pleased with themselves for their accomplishment. "That's the arrogance," I told them. And their faces fell, and we talked about it. Now, this bias I had against people in Massachusetts was well-earned on their part, but of course it's not true for everyone. Still, it was a definite cultural imprint, the rules of a place, as it were. And every place has the rules. Alaska has its own culture. Up until a few years ago, if you'd mentioned visiting Alaska, people would talk to you about the weather, the nature, the sunlight, the people. Now, more often than not, you get asked about Sarah Palin. But very few people know the real culture of Alaska, or more correctly, the real cultures, because there's definitely more than one. You know that's true for Colorado. Colorado is more than just Denver. As you begin the work of looking for a settled minister, let me tell you a story about how important culture is. This is a story of one of our congregations in Vermont. The small congregation had a track record. They would call a minister who they would quickly find that didn't fit for them. It never lasted more than 2 years. In fact, they went through 8 ministers in 13 years. There had to be something wrong with the congregation, a ministerial colleague told me. Then they went against the standard advice and they took a risk on someone who was just out of seminary, a younger woman. She stayed with that congregation for 8 years before moving on. The congregation loved her, doubled in size, and added a new wing to the church. What had changed? The congregation called a minister who'd been born and raised in Vermont. She knew the culture. She knew the way that people did things and what they responded to. She expected the congregation to act like Vermonters, and they did. And it was a good fit. They understood each other, having a common bond. The congregation understood that the minister knew where they were coming from, and the minister understood the ways of the congregation. One of your challenges in your ministerial search will be to clear to any minister who might be interested in you about what Fort Collins culture is like and what is the culture of this particular congregation. Another challenge will be to see if you find a minister who likes the culture of this congregation and community. I moved away from Massachusetts because the culture wasn't a good fit for me. What kind of minister would be a good fit for Fort Collins? We all have biases, and we need to be aware and to be able to talk about these biases to begin the real work and real conversation of living our values. All too often, our congregations get involved in other kind of biases, biases that they aren't aware of, biases they don't realize they have, but are perfectly obvious to others. One story in particular stays with me, coming from a congregation that invited a guest minister to speak. This minister was African American. He arrived on Sunday morning in a suit with a folder. He was greeted by the greeter that morning, who asked him, "Are you here to clean the building this morning?" Now, having visited over 450 UU congregations in nearly 20 years with the UUA, I can't ever recall anyone ever asked me if I was there to clean the building. I worked with a congregation just a few years ago that insisted it needed a minister who was going to attract young families to congregations. Now, most congregations say that, actually. But this congregation was absolutely certain that the only kind of minister who could do that was a younger, married, straight, white man who had children. And once when I was a guest preacher, the congregations had two visitors that morning, two visitors who used an electric scooter to get around. The worship leader that morning asked all of the new visitors to stand. There were no gasps, no conversations after the sermon with the person who said it, no apologies to the visitors who left quickly. There was some denial when I asked someone if they had heard it too. Oh, I'm sure she didn't mean that. She'd never say anything to hurt people. Oh, I'm sure she just didn't see them, someone else said. And another person said, well, we all get flustered from time to time and misspeak. When I asked, would someone say something to the worship leader about this, someone said, it's not a good idea to make the worship leader upset. Our ministers of color, our ministers who are bisexual, gay, lesbian, and transgender, our ministers with disability, they still encounter prejudice as part of the search process. And most of our ministers with disability either hide their disability or figure out a way to downplay it so they can hope to find work with a congregation. Sometimes the prejudice the ministers face is obvious, sometimes it's subtle, but it often keeps a congregation from finding the best match. The Vermont congregation that called one of its own was able to see that calling a minister who knew the Vermont culture mattered more than any prejudice they might have about calling a minister who was female, younger, bisexual. Where I continue to see good and successful matches is when a congregation is able to say who it is, what it's about, and where it hopes to go. It doesn't seem to have to be a uniform voice, but just a clear one from the congregation. The minister has a clear sense of what the culture of the place is that she is coming to or is willing to learn. And all assume goodwill and good intention. And when there is disagreement and conflict, they are able to talk about it. They are like Pete and Pickles, able to see and appreciate the gifts that the other has and allow to be benefited from the other. And when this happens, it is magical. And this is your challenge. As Dennis asked Santa, do you believe in yourself? Santa Claus can come in many forms. As you undertake this process, I want to ask you a couple of questions that I often lead when I teach workshops on the Enneagram. The first two questions are fairly easy. The third question can be a little more challenging. What are you like at your best? What are you like at your worst? The more challenging question is, what are you like on an average day when you're on autopilot? I think of that greeter who asked the minister if he were there to clean the building. She was someone who was on autopilot. I have no doubts that when the greeter learned that the man in the suit was in fact the guest minister, that she was appalled at herself, embarrassed, and already making excuses. I encourage you to think about how you might be at your best, at your worst, how you might be on an average day, have responded if you had been next to the greeter when they had said something like this. Some people would have wanted to brush it aside. Some would get outraged at the greeter. Some would want to apologize. Some would just simply say, we have work to do. Let's figure out how we can learn from this. When things happen, we have the opportunity to make the most of the opportunities and use them for a greater good. Each of us has the capacity to become aware of who we are, what we can do, and when we do that, we can change the world. It can be as simple as talking about our biases with others, of seeing the gifts of Pete and Pickles who are in our lives, and this often leads to bigger things. We need to remember that there's a little bit of Sarah Palin, the greeter of Pete and Pickles, in all of us. And it is important for us to know who we are and what our culture is. None of us are so exceptional that we can't do harm, and none of us are so insignificant that we can't make a difference. We must believe in ourselves. Believe in yourself. Don't think about elephants. Just live your values. Each of you can make a difference.
During this month of September,